I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. The city council has voted unanimously to ban sugary drinks from kids' meals in an effort to fight rising rates of childhood obesity. Is legislating menus the best way to change people's behavior when it comes to healthy eating? And the General Assembly in Annapolis is considering ways to shield consumers from high prescription drug prices. One suggestion is to establish a commission to determine how much drug companies can charge. Should drug prices be regulated the way prices for insurance and energy are? And in Washington, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has established yet another opioid task force that targets manufacturers and distributors of painkillers. The Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Delighted that you've chosen to join us. Thank you very much. Today, it's the Midday Health Watch on Monday night. The Baltimore City Council voted unanimously to approve a measure that requires restaurants to replace the sugary soft drinks that are offered in most kids' meals with more healthful options like milk, juice, or water. It's a response to rampant childhood obesity in the city. The health department estimates that as many as one-third of high school students in Baltimore are obese or overweight. In Annapolis, lawmakers are considering controls on soaring prescription drug prices as well as provisions that will bolster the beleaguered Affordable Care Act. And they sparred over a bill that would impose tough new conditions on the use of life-saving Narcan by repeat opioid users. Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen joins me here in Studio A, as she does for all of our health watches. Good to see you.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Tom.
So it's been a busy time when it comes to public policy and legislative proposals, both really in all three places, on the local level, the state level, and even the national level. Let's talk about this sugary drinks bill. This is a bill that you very vociferously supported. The city council passed it 15-0. So, obviously widespread support in that form. What does it do? What does it say?
I'm so glad to be working with a city council who are a public health council. I mean, they understand the core of these public health principles. You may recall that 2 years ago, we worked on legislation to put a warning label on sugary drinks in an attempt to level the playing field and give parents and families information. That bill did not pass the former council, and this bill, as you just mentioned, passed 15-0. I, as an emergency physician, I see patients come to me with chronic diseases. But for the first time in our history, I've been treating children who have illnesses that we formerly only saw in adults. I'm seeing 8-year-olds who weigh 200 pounds, 15-year-olds who have adult-onset diabetes, 13-year-olds who have heart disease because of the food that they are eating, the drinks that they're having. Now, sugary drinks are a major source of added sugar that contributes to childhood obesity. And parents have come to us over the years saying, why is it that kids' meals contain sodas as the default choice, and parents have to pay extra for something like milk or 100% fruit juice or bottled water? So this bill would be to flip that default choice. Parents can still choose to buy their kids soda if they want, but what's included in the default meal is now going to be a healthy drink. And studies have shown that these types of changes in retail practices make a difference, and Baltimore is now going to be joining 9 other cities and counties that have made the healthy choice the easy choice. But we will be the first city on the East Coast and the biggest city to be able to make this change. And I'm really, really glad that our elected leaders agree with public health advocates and pediatricians. I mean, we had dozens of public health leaders and advocates turn out for a press conference ahead of the council hearing. And so this is amazing.
It's interesting to hear you say the difference between the kinds of children's or the kinds of diseases you're seeing in children now and earlier in your career. Because when I saw this statistic that 1 in 3 high school students is overweight or obese. First of all, as I understand it, that lines up fairly well with the population at large. I mean, adults have the same percentage. It's somewhere between 32% and 36%, depending on who you read. But I just remember in my own childhood, and I am now one of those people who I assume would be called overweight. I mean, if I lost 15 pounds, I'd be at the recommended weight, you know, for my height and stuff. But if I lost 15 pounds, I'd also weigh what I weighed as a sophomore in high school, you know. And when I was in high school, I just don't remember most of us being overweight. I mean, this seems like a fairly new thing within the last generation or two that kids, you know, in their teen years, because, you know, kids generally are pretty active and they're running around and they're doing stuff. It really is a generational difference that children now, middle school, junior high school, high school, are having. I guess it's an eating disorder, right? I mean, or it's a... it's a quality of food disorder, whatever.
Well, our studies show that 1 in 4 of our youth in Baltimore City drink a soda every single day. And this is terrible. I mean, sodas contain empty calories. They have no nutritional value whatsoever. Public health advocates agree that cutting out sodas is one very easy thing we can do that can make a huge impact on our lives, because overweight and obese children turn into overweight and obese adults who then have chronic illnesses. Heart disease is the number one killer across the country. It's the number one killer here in Baltimore City. And if we can help our children to level the playing field, that makes a big difference. And I have to say, part of what's contributed to this change in norm and change in culture is advertising. We know that beverage companies disproportionately market to inner city communities, to communities of color. They show sports stars and pop stars who are holding up Pepsi and Coca-Cola and how cool it is. And that then leads to stores then supplying these drinks and for families and children purchasing them without realizing the detrimental effects to their health, both at that time and later on. And so we see bills like this as one step in the right direction to change that narrative. And already these diseases like heart disease disproportionately affect communities of color. This is one thing that we can do to level the playing field.
I guess the recommendation for the amount of sugar you should have in a daily diet is 6 teaspoons per day, but the average soda has more than that. So if you have one soda, you've already consumed your, you know, your allotment, as it were, for the day of sugar. So sodas should be special occasion drinks. They should not be daily things. What about so-called diet sodas, you know, Coke Zero? They call it Coke Zero because it has 0 calories, I guess. But it has to have some sugar in it, I assume.
Well, it's got sugar substitutes, which some studies find that these sugar substitutes, when consumed in large quantities, can have ill side effects too. That's why we recommend for children who have nutrition needs, instead of filling themselves up with sodas of any kind, water, milk, and occasionally 100% fruit juice, that's what we recommend. And community groups are the ones that came to us saying that they want legislation passed around these drinks, because it's about information, it's about leveling the playing field, and it is about empowering parents with choice. You're not empowering parents with choice if they don't even have access to water or to healthy foods and vegetables. And that's another part of what we were working on in the health department under Mayor Pugh's leadership.
And for people who say, well, this bill doesn't have any teeth because parents can still go ahead and override and, you know, pay a little extra for the soda. What you're saying is that this is giving parents a real incentive not to do that. And I guess, you know, if you're an 8-year-old and you start going to these restaurants and getting a water or a milk with your meal all the time, you're going to get used to that. So that by the time you're a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old, the chances are, I mean, is there data that says, you know, if you started doing that when you're 8, you're going to continue doing that 8 or 10 years later?
Absolutely. And we know this anecdotally, too, that our dietary habits are shaped early on, that we learn from what our caregivers do, too. And this change in norm didn't happen overnight. So it will take time and concerted action. But right now, this is something that just makes sense. I mean, why should families have to pay extra for something like water or milk when that's something that's actually good for their kids? You know, the opposition, who are beverage associations and lobbyists and retailers, will say, well, we're making choices for parents. Actually, we're not. We're empowering them with choice. And we're also helping our retailers, too. There are national chains like Panera that have already made the change for the default option. They haven't seen a decrease in sales. And so we look forward to working with our stores so that we can really work towards a better and healthier Baltimore.
Yeah, and it's, I guess it's not even just Panera. I mean, it's places like McDonald's and Wendy's and Dairy Queen, Burger King, even IHOP. They've been doing this in some cases since 2015. They've shown no difference or no particularly, deleterious effect to their bottom line. I mean, as a response to people who say on the platform of political philosophy that it's not a good idea for the government, for us as a society, to dictate what people can and can't purchase, when and where they can purchase it, etc. How do you respond then to that? I mean, you talk about choice. It was that's really the meat of the argument, because there are people who say, you know, menus for children should be the last thing that the city council should be involved in.
We're not banning anything. Parents, if they wish, can still choose to buy sodas or other drinks and food for their kids. We're simply switching the default option because we believe that these healthier options need to be made available. And it is about behavioral change and behavioral economics. So this is about empowering parents. It's also ultimately about the public's health. That's why so many pediatricians and public health experts and community groups came out in support of this legislation. When we're in the middle of an epidemic, when we have children who are afflicted with illnesses that we never before saw in kids, we need to act on it now. And I like to refer to Congressman Elijah Cummings, one of my heroes and our representatives here in Baltimore, who talks about the work that we do that's not just about the children who are here right now, but about the generations of children yet unborn. This is what we must do for them.
Yeah, because you're talking about type 2 diabetes, heart disease, tooth decay, all sorts of things. When it comes to political philosophy and, you know, influencing the markets for various things, there is some legislation in Annapolis that's being considered around prescription drug prices. Mm-hmm. What's being proposed? A number of health advocacy groups are behind this bill, and or some of the bills, and as are you. Tell me what they're proposing and why you think it's a good idea.
There are two sets of legislation that we are working on around healthcare for this legislative session in Annapolis. One is about strengthening and protecting the Affordable Care Act, because there are over 400,000 Marylanders who benefited and have health insurance because of the ACA. And the last thing that we need is for that to be taken away. The second set of bills, and we're set to testify on the bills actually this afternoon, is around prescription drug pricing. Prescription drugs are a major reason for why our healthcare costs are so high. And working in the ER, I've seen so many people, including our seniors, who are cutting their high blood pressure pills in half or in quarters, who are making the decision every day about what they should pay for, whether it's their prescription drugs for their heart disease or whether it is their insulin or whether they're going to be paying for their rent. And we see this in Baltimore, for example, with naloxone or Narcan, the opioid antidote, that I'm having to ration this life-saving medication. It's available by the pennies in other countries, but I'm having to decide every day who is going to get it and who is not, which is the definition of rationing. And so there are a couple of bills that will help us to reduce the cost of prescription drugs. One is to remove the so-called gag order, which is which this gag rule is imposed on pharmacists at the moment to prohibit pharmacists from discussing cheaper, lower-priced alternatives to medications, which makes no sense.
Yeah, if ever there were a rule that reeked of political lobbying, it's that.
That's,
I mean,
right.
your pharmacist is not allowed to say, okay, here you are, you have this prescription for this brand name medication. If you bought this, you know, this alternative, it's the same drug and it would cost you less. And the pharmacists are not allowed to tell you that now.
That's right. And so this is about accurate, transparent information and is a no-brainer. The other bill that we're working on is to set up a drug cost review commission, basically a statewide commission of nonpartisan folks who will come together and experts who will come together and determine what is a reasonable price to be setting so that people are able to afford drugs and so that we are compensating the manufacturers of these pharmaceuticals appropriately as well. And so, again, we're testifying to this because ultimately it's about access to life and access to life-saving medications.
All right, we got to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll talk about how you determine what a reasonable price for a drug is, because obviously the drug companies are saying we know what it is, and that's why they're setting their prices the way they are. Lots more to talk about as well. We will take your calls, questions, and comments. Dr. Lena Nguyen is Baltimore City's health commissioner, and she joins us regularly for the Midday Health Watch. Our conversation will continue with Dr. Nguyen and with you, 410-662-8780. That's our phone number here at Midday, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, a quick word about tomorrow's show. It's Midday at the Movies. Maryland Film Festival director Jed Dietz and Baltimore Magazine managing editor Max Weiss will share their predictions for Oscar winners. The Academy Awards are on Sunday, so get your Harry Winston jewelry lined up and ready to go. Plus, we're going to talk about the phenomenon that is the Black Panther movie. I saw this movie last night. Luke, have you seen this movie yet? He's nodding and said, no, yeah, you got to go. It's a terrific movie. It's really something. So we'll talk about that as well. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Countdown. That's the new play at Baltimore's Strand Theater. So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen, the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. We have a treat from Rick Abruzzese, who used to work for Mayor O'Malley back in the day, and he calls our attention to a new ABLE Foundation report that has just been released. It's called Alcohol and Cigarette Tax Policies Improve Public Health in Maryland. So, I mean, this is it. When we talk about political philosophy, Lena, I mean, you know, adding a surcharge to things that are bad for you and making it cheaper for things that are good for you. There is some data that says, you know, this works. Fewer people are smoking because smoking is so expensive.
That's right. This report illustrates what we know to be true, which is that public health policy changes behavior and it improves health and it saves lives. Raising the minimum age of tobacco, for example, tobacco 21 is something that's been done in other states. I and my fellow health officers in Maryland have supported this legislation over the years. It's in front of the legislature again this year. Increasing taxes for tobacco and for alcohol dramatically reduces the number of people who are smoking. It dramatically reduces the number of illnesses that are caused by these substances. And so I think it's important for us to consider the health impact as well as the cost of doing nothing. Because if we do nothing, we're going to have thousands and thousands of Marylanders who will continue to die from preventable illnesses. And we'll also increase the cost of a medical care later on down the line, too.
Yeah, and of course, the cost of prescription drugs, which we were talking about right before the break, is one of the big dimensions of healthcare costs. Before we continue with our conversation about prescription drugs, let's take a step back and go to a phone call from John in Baltimore. You want to talk about the sugary drinks thing again. John, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen. John, why don't you turn your radio off and tell us what you have on your mind?
Hello.
Hi, John. You're on the air. Why don't you turn your radio off and tell us what's what you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, the problem is even the as far as the even the blood pressure medication, if we have proper diet, a lot of it will come down. For example, I don't take any medication for blood pressure. I avoid a lot of bad things, salt, and the other thing about the smoothies, the smoothies are not so great, and everywhere you go, oh, you should have a smoothie. We still have our teeth. We should chew an apple, not make it into liquid.
All right. Well, John, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Of course, Lena, you know, making healthy choices is easier for some people than for others. I mean, if you don't have access to a grocery store, it's hard for you to find things on the shelves that are not sugary drinks. If you don't have access to the kinds of restaurants that are going to give you healthful meals or healthful meal options, low-cal things, low-fat things, low-sugar things, it's going to be really difficult. If the nearest place to take the kids after school is the McDonald's or the Burger King, and it's just a two-transfer bus ride to go to a better restaurant, it's hard.
You're absolutely right. We often talk about this narrative of choice, but we have to recognize that choice is based on privilege, and that not all of us have the privilege of choosing and affording whole foods and healthy drinks, which is the reason why, again, this default, changing that default beverage is so important. Because why should parents have to pay more for something that's healthy for their children? But I want to address something that John said. He made, I think, two very good points. One is that we are over-medicalizing. We are saying if you have high blood pressure or you have high blood sugars, you need to take a medication. For some people, that absolutely may be true. But for others, changing diet, changing lifestyle is where we can start. And even better for us to prevent these issues from occurring through healthy lifestyles in the first place, which there is something that we as policymakers can do to enable that. And John also made the point about added sugars in drinks, in smoothies and other things. And I think it's a very fair point that we should be looking...
It could look healthy, but maybe not so much.
Or even being labeled as being healthy. So take a look at these added sugars, total sugars on the labels. And when in doubt, water is always the best thing that we can do to hydrate ourselves.
Right. The only smoothies you should drink are the ones made completely with bark. Just bark. Ground bark smoothies. That's it. Nothing else. Nothing
Don't
else.
Know if I'll provide the endorsement today, but maybe next time.
So back to this effort to help control prescription drug prices. The pharmaceutical industry points to heavy research and development costs. People who purport or advocate for this legislation say, well, they spend an awful lot of time and money advertising as well. I mean, who determines? I mean, we have a commission to determine energy prices. When BGE wants to raise rates for electricity, they have to go to the commission and say, here's why we're doing this. We have commissions that regulate insurance costs for car insurance and things like that. Does it work the same way with prescription drugs? Is it possible for an outside entity to go to Pfizer or one of these gigantic Merck, you know, these companies and say, we know what it costs for you to make this drug. You can only charge X.
Well, my question is, why shouldn't we be able to do that? For me, pharmaceuticals are about saving lives. If people are being priced out of the ability to take medications, it means that they are being priced out of the ability to live. Now, pharmaceutical companies will argue that it's a matter of research and development, that they have to put a lot into research and development. But when we look at actually where they spend their money, they spend twice as much money on marketing as they do on R&D. And so this proposal in front of the Maryland legislature is to have a commission of experts who will come together and determine what is a reasonable price to charge, which should also depend on what is happening and what the alternatives are. And if there is a state of a public health epidemic around something, for example, around opioid overdose and naloxone is the antidote, perhaps there needs to be an exception made at a time of a public health emergency. Bottom line is that this is a matter of saving lives and about the cost to society, because an individual who is not getting a medication will also end up costing society a lot more in terms of medical bills. And so that's why there is this proposal in front of the legislature, which we hope that they will consider, because it is the a major reason why people cannot afford their medical care.
And you brought up the example of naloxone, which is this life-saving drug that opioid users can use if they're in distress and they're overdosing. Would this kind of legislation affect the price of naloxone? In other words, would this commission be able to study what it costs to make naloxone? You mentioned the fact that it's prescribed or distributed for pennies a pill in other places, would they be able to say, look, you're price gouging? Of course, in Maryland, one of the first states to, I think the first state, to have a specific price gouging bill about pharmaceuticals. But would this commission in the instance of naloxone be able to say, here's what it should cost, here's what it does cost, you got to give it to us at our price?
In the case of the price gouging bill, that only applied for generic medications. And so I'm glad that passed last year. Maryland became the first state in the country to do so, but it only applies for generics. So my hope is that for something like naloxone, we can have a price set that is a reasonable price. There are other things that can be done on the federal level, including the federal government under President Trump can negotiate the price of naloxone directly with the manufacturers. This is what I've been urging for our federal government to do, including a couple months ago, I was able to advocate directly to the then acting Secretary of Health and Human Services to do so. The federal government and the state government can also allocate more funding for naloxone as well. There are multiple ways for us to get this medication into the hands of our most vulnerable residents. And frankly, I, as a public health official, I don't care how it's done. I just need this to be done because I'm seeing the toll for our residents every single day.
64,000 people died of opioid overdoses last year. Time Magazine has a 90-page edition just out yesterday, I think, of nothing but photographs and accompanying text about opioid use and the opioid epidemic. There are no ads in this edition of Time Magazine. It's one photographer and one writer who have put this thing together to focus people's attention on it. I mean, and obviously the federal government has huge leverage because this is a national problem. This is not just something we're dealing with here in Baltimore or in Maryland. And with that kind of leverage, you know, you would think they'd be able to say, look, we'll buy a lot of this stuff from you, and you have to, because of the volume, you've got to give it to us at a better price.
Here's what I'm concerned about with the opioid epidemic. I mean, there are multiple things I'm concerned about, including the fact that there are people dying at unprecedented rates across the country and right here in Baltimore and in Maryland. But I'm particularly concerned that while there are many stories being told, and I'm glad that finally we're telling these stories of how of people struggling with addiction, getting treatment for addiction, I'm concerned that there are so many bad policies that are being proposed that are actually detrimental. There are policies to turn back the clock and incarcerate individuals. There's a bill that is being heard this week in the House, this House Bill 771, sponsored by Delegate Cassidy, Delegate Shalega, and others, that will make people who get naloxone pay back the price of their life-saving antidote. These individuals will be forced into treatment against their will and potentially even be incarcerated for needing to be revived for their overdose. I mean, it actually does not make sense. It's chilling and nonsensical. It's not acknowledging that addiction is a disease, that treatment works, and that forcing people into treatment is not effective. The problem that we
and
have
it's
is...
it's not effective because if they're not ready to do it, it's not going to work. So our only option then is to keep giving them naloxone when they overdose and to, you know, just, you know, adduce the terrible effects of keeping taking these drugs. I mean, is their willingness to be in treatment a really essential element of effective treatment?
Well, let me use two analogies here, because when people hear about addiction and think about addiction, they think about it differently than they do other diseases. But science shows us that addiction is a disease, just like other illnesses. So let's think about somebody who is dying from a peanut allergy. We would never consider saying to this person, I'm not going to give you an EpiPen because it might make you eat more peanuts next time. If somebody is dying in front of us, even if it's their 10th time requiring an EpiPen, we would absolutely save their lives because there is no hope for tomorrow if we don't save their lives today. And then I'll use the second analogy, which is let's think about addiction the way that we do heart disease. If we follow the best recommendations for heart disease, a person who is dying from a heart attack now, they need to have their life saved first. But then they need to have long-term treatment, including with medications and potentially with lifelong lifestyle changes. But if somebody skips medications and eats an unhealthy diet, we would never say, well, we would make you pay back the taxpayer contribution to your care. And we would never propose incarceration for their illness. I think a major issue with the whole, well, let's force you into treatment, is that we actually don't have enough resources for treatment for people who are requesting
it. Who want to have the treatment, yeah.
That's right. And so having a bill that requires treatment is not acknowledging the reality of what we have made available. And so I would hope that for all those individuals who want to tell their sad stories and who want to do something about the opioid epidemic, there are actually things that they can do. They can work on naloxone availability. They can work on increasing treatment, including to 24/7 treatment centers. They can strengthen the Affordable Care Act and reduce the price of prescription drugs. And very importantly, they can help us with reducing stigma. The last thing that we need is to further incarcerate individuals with addiction. We know that the war on drugs has not worked. We know that these policies that further stigmatize will hurt communities, in particular communities like ours that have already incarcerated a whole generation of people and have already incarcerated particularly Black and Brown people and have seen addiction as a moral failing instead of as the disease that it is. And so I sincerely hope that our lawmakers who are wanting to do something about the opioid epidemic, that they turn to public health experts, because we know what works and we are happy to advise them on the policy changes that will save lives. The last thing that we need to do is to turn back the clock on the gains that have been made.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. Let's go to the phones. Michael in Rosedale, you have a comment about pharmacists and what they are allowed and disallowed from telling their patients. Welcome to the show.
Hi, everybody. This is my first time calling. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, before the break, you had said something. You just said it really fast, and I wanted to ask you to elaborate on what you meant about when the pharmacists, at their discretion, have a choice not to tell you that there's a cheaper option for medication available. The reason why I asked you this is because I just got LASIK eye surgery done for my vision correction. My doctor gave me these two prescriptions for eye drops for my eyes so I don't get infected. And my insurance didn't cover it. So I asked what the retail price of it came to, like $150. And then when I went back to the LASIK eye place, they gave me a discount for alternative drugs. The same thing, but it's just a cheaper drug. And then I brought that coupon and I gave it to the pharmacist, and he had this look on his face like, oh, wow, how did you get this? Oh, okay. Well, since you have it, I might as well give it to you. Here you go, $30. I'm just like, It's kind of like he looked at me like he almost like, oh man, I'm mad that he found out that he had this, but since he knows, I got to give it to him anyway. So I just wanted you to elaborate more about that.
Well, thank you for the call, Michael, and good luck with the eye surgery. So again, it's this gag rule about what pharmacists are allowed to say and not say to their customers.
That's right. Pharmacists will often know if there is a cheaper alternative. It could be a cheaper alternative because it's a generic medication, which has exactly the same effect and the same efficacy, but is not on patent, and therefore it's cheaper. Or sometimes it depends on a person's insurance, too. On one person's insurance, maybe it covers this one brand name medication, but not another that also works the same way. And as I understand, and actually I was really shocked to find out that currently there is this gag rule that prevents pharmacists from giving information about the cheaper alternative. It's not saying the pharmacist has to do it. It's just saying that right now, the pharmacist can't even do it if they know that there's a cheaper alternative. And that just makes no sense. We should be empowering consumers and patients with the best information available to make the best choice for themselves and for their families. And so this bill would be to remove that gag rule and to allow pharmacists to give transparent, accurate information.
And again, when you hear things like this, and there's a similar situation with guns, the NRA has successfully prohibited the study of guns and the study of gun violence. So the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, and other government entities would like to collect some data about guns. And the gun lobby has successfully disallowed that line of inquiry. They're basically saying, we don't want you to think about this. We don't want you to investigate this. And this just seems on its face that the pharmaceutical industry has basically said, we're going to disallow your telling your customers that they have an alternative to our product.
And we see this the same way for many different industries. We face opposition from the beverage lobby about choices. We face opposition, and you mentioned, from the gun lobby. We face opposition from alcohol and tobacco industries about choices. And that's why public health policy is so important, because for us, we don't have an ulterior motive here. We're not trying to sell a product. We're trying to save lives. And we want to use evidence and science to be able to do so.
All right. I have to make the choice to take a little break, because if I don't, our director and engineer, Luke Spicknall, will choose to force feed me a bark smoothie, and I don't want to do that. So we are going to take a quick break, and then we will continue the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore. Your calls and comments are welcome. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. By the way, today marks an anniversary for one of our beloved colleagues here at WYPR. On this very day, 15 years ago, which was a Friday, Gilbert Sandler shared his very first Baltimore story. He's been delighting us with stories ever since. Gil recently celebrated his 95th birthday, and while he has stopped recording new stories, we continue to delight in Gil's wonderful tales every Friday morning right here on WYPR. So happy anniversary, Gil, and happy birthday. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's the Midday Health Watch with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. You are welcome to join us with your comments and questions about matters of health. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And to find us in the Twittersphere, @MiddayWYPR. We have a message from Rob Patterson. He describes himself as a Baltimore global health professional. He says, thank you, Dr. Wen, for consistently delivering 100% timely and accurate public health messages to further reduce sugar consumption, Rob writes. Know that store-bought orange and fruit juices also have a lot of added sugar and fructose. Same for tonic water and yogurt with fruit already added by the company. So to eliminate added sugar from these sources, eat whole fruits rather than store-bought juice, and substitute seltzer water for tonic water, and add fresh fruit to plain yogurt rather than buy yogurt with fruit already added. So thanks for that comment, Rob. That all seems like pretty sound advice.
Good advice. There are added sugar, added sodium in all kinds of substances that you wouldn't normally think that there would be added sugar and sodium in. And so look at your label and aim for, again, drink water as much as possible. And there are these types of steps we can take today.
And it's hard. I mean, if you're I have three or four friends who just really like to drink Coke all day while they're at their job in the office and stuff. I mean, they got used to drinking regular Coke years and years ago, and to stop drinking regular Coke, even to move to the Diet Coke for them, is hard. And to move from no Coke, or, you know, to move to no Coke whatsoever, to drink seltzer water or regular water, it's difficult. I mean, no one's downplaying the difficulty of this if you have the habit of drinking these sugary drinks in the normal course of your day for years and years.
Small steps can make a big difference, especially when we consider what are the consequences of not making these changes. You'll hear people talk all the time about how exercise is hard. And yes, exercise is hard. Committing to a routine is hard. So is changing your diet. But it's just as important. Actually, it's more important to cut out these sugary drinks, because they are a major preventable cause of obesity, diabetes, tooth decay, heart disease, and other of these major killers, and that have a huge impact on our lifestyle.
Speaking of small steps, Republicans, quite famously before Mr. Trump was elected president, tried many times, more than 50 times, to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and even tried again while Mr. Trump was in office, and very famously failed in that effort. However, they have been taking small steps to dismantle parts of it. In the tax reform bill that Republicans passed over right over the around the Christmas holiday, the individual mandate to purchase insurance was eliminated. There's no longer a penalty, or as of 2020, there will no longer be a penalty if you don't have health insurance, which is one of the requirements in the ACA. Wall Street Journal reporting today that 20 different Republican state attorneys general are seeking to overturn the Affordable Care Act in a lawsuit that basically says the lawsuit alleges that it's now unconstitutional to have any kind of mandate since this was gotten rid of by the Congress and the tax reform bill. So they're using that argument to just repeal the whole bill. There are several states, including right here in Maryland, where legislators are taking actions to try to address some of these problems, these holes in the cheese, as you will, about the Affordable Care Act. So what are we talking about when it comes to defending the ACA and trying to shore it up here in Maryland?
I think every time we talk about the ACA, it quickly becomes a political discussion. And for me, it's not about politics. It's about people's lives. I practiced medicine before and after the ACA, and it used to be that I routinely treated patients in the ER who came in because of a preventable problem that was not treated, but then became extremely serious. I remember treating a young woman who was diagnosed with breast cancer and ended up dying actually shortly after I saw her. She had three little kids who were left without their mother, and she would have had her breast cancer diagnosed and treated, but she didn't have insurance. And she didn't have insurance not because she didn't want it, but because she couldn't pay for it. I mean, the ACA is literally a life and death issue. We have 400,000 Marylanders who are insured because of the ACA. We have to see healthcare as a basic human right. We have to see access to health insurance as fundamental to that right. And so we are working on, and the Baltimore City Health Department, we're supporting legislation that would protect the provisions of the ACA. So an example is Senate Bill 1011 and the corresponding House bill, which helps to enforce the individual mandate. And what that does is it provides a way for residents without health insurance to make a down payment on a coverage plan through the individual market. So that's one way to enforce the individual, to enforce the individual mandate, and to put the money that they otherwise would have been penalized on towards a down payment on their own health insurance plan. Another bill, Senate Bill 690 and the corresponding House bill, they help those patients who otherwise would be priced out of care. There is this affordability gap where there are individuals who are not eligible for public programs, but who also cannot afford private insurance. And this will help to have a basic health plan that will provide a basic level of services at a reduced cost for individuals to at least ensure some level of health coverage. So, I mean, I give my full support to these legislation and to anything else that will help us, because ultimately it's not about the politics of the ACA, which has become such a politicized term. It's about what's happening to our residents here in Baltimore City and across Maryland.
And, you know, Lena, I hear you when you talk about, as a doctor, the life and death effects of this public policy debate. But of course, it is politics. And it's interesting that there perhaps is more consensus than we acknowledge around some of these issues. For example, Vinnie DeMarco, the president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, who has worked in the healthcare advocacy for years, he says that nationally, 74% of Democrats, 71% of Republicans support the idea of an independent commission overseeing prescription drug prices. So it's not like there's this great gap in terms of political philosophy between the two sides, as there often is on other issues. When we talk about affordability of insurance, that really speaks to the issue of access, doesn't it? I mean, it doesn't matter if you got all these great hospitals in the world, or in Baltimore, we have plenty of great hospitals, right? But if you can't afford to go to them, it doesn't do anybody any good. What's your sense? Because you talk to political leaders all the time. You're testifying in Annapolis all the time. You're doing nationally broadcast forums and commentaries about various issues of public health. What's your sense about the political will to address these problems with the ACA on the state level?
It seems that in our current environment nationally, that the state is where we have to focus our efforts. And not even the state, sometimes it's the local level that we have to focus our advocacy, which is why I'm very glad to be working with such a progressive city council that understands public health. I'm also glad to work with so many legislators who, on the state level, who see and who hear the stories from their constituents that are the same stories as what I'm hearing. I mean, people are calling the health department every day, asking me about what's going to happen to them, saying that they are afraid of what will happen when the ACA is repealed or if Medicaid is gutted. And I hope that we will be able to channel that energy into policy change that will protect us as Marylanders and as Baltimoreans.
All right, we have just a little bit of time, and all of a sudden, several callers. Roxy in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. What's
Great.
On your mind?
Thank you. Well, I'm actually in Annapolis now to testify in favor of this prescription drug bill. I'm the president of United Local 7, which represents service workers, hotel workers, restaurant workers. And one other reason why we need to address this ever-rising cost of health care and prescription drugs is that it's having a very negative drag on wages. So when we go in and go to negotiations and are trying to improve wages and benefits for workers, just to hold on to their benefits, it's requiring more and more and more dollars, which means there's less dollars for raises. And so it's really a crisis in the workplace, not just for workers, but for small businesses as well who want to provide benefits to their employees. And it's the prescription drug costs that are really fueling the rising cost of premiums for health insurance.
All right, well,
so
thanks.
I'm glad that Maryland is going to address this because the federal government hasn't been able to.
Well, Roxy, thank you so much for your comment. Let's go to Raymond in White Marsh. Raymond, as I understand it, you are a small business owner yourself. What's your comment?
Oh, my comment is I know that there's a big epidemic with, pill popping and, heroin use, but I've noticed in the last 5 years that more and more methadone clinics are popping up. And it's like I've had three employees over the last, I don't know how many years, get onto the program, and they're dirty. And for some reason, the clinics actually let them go ahead and pass the urine tests all the time. And it drives me insane seeing it. And maybe they should start looking at some of these government-run programs and start really going in there and seeing what they're doing with these individuals, because they're not helping them out.
And Raymond, is your business a business that disallows people to work for you if they have not passed a urine test, if they have not proven to themselves to be drug-free?
Yeah, they're supposed to be drug-free, but I see it every now and then, and they smoke marijuana and still pass the test, and it drives me nuts. So, I don't know how to go about it, but it's like our taxpayers are paying for these programs. And they've popped these methadone clinics up in the last 5 years. I've seen so many new ones, it's not even funny.
Okay, well, thanks, Raymond. Dr. Nguyen, we're out of time, but any quick comment for Raymond's call?
Well, I think Roxy, first of all, for testifying, it brings up a good point that we are paying for it in some way, even if we're not paying for it directly. And to Raymond, I do agree that we need to regulate and ensure that all of our treatment centers are high quality, but we have to remember that addiction is a disease, that treatment works, and that there are three FDA-approved medications for the treatment of substance use for opioid use. They are methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone, and we have to make all three forms of treatment available to people at the time that they need and treat everyone with the dignity and compassion that they deserve.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, always good to see you. Look forward to the next time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the Health Commissioner for the City of Baltimore. That's it for us today. Lunch was provided today by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz and Max Weiss. We'll talk about the new Black Panther movie, and we'll throw out a few Oscar predictions ahead of Sunday night's Academy Awards. Plus, J. Wynn Russick will have a review of Countdown. That's the new play at the Baltimore Strand Theater. By the way, looking ahead to Friday, we'll begin our series of Conversations with the Candidates. These are live, in-depth interviews with the leading contenders in the upcoming primary elections here in Maryland. My first guest guest will be Alec Ross. He's a technology policy expert, formerly in the Obama administration. He's one of seven Democratic gubernatorial candidates vying for the chance to oppose Governor Larry Hogan in November. So our conversations with the candidates begins with Alec Ross coming up here on Midday Friday. Thanks for joining us today. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's coming up right after the NPR newscast. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.
This is your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.